Hi, I'm an Al-Anon from Hueytown, Alabama. My name's Bo Templin. Hi. It's good to be here this morning. It's good to be here this weekend. We've been looking forward to getting over to Georgia. We like AA and Al-Anon and Alateen in Georgia, and we got a lot of friends over this way. And I've gotten to see a lot of old friends already, some people that we've met before in the fellowship, and that's always fun for us. And to get to see old friends, and then of course to make new friends. And Charlie and I both just want to say thank you for having us over here and allowing us to be a part of this. This is a great way to enjoy recovery. And we were told early on, learn how to have fun in recovery. And believe me, we're having fun today in recovery. And this is a big part of it, to be involved in things like this. You know, the first year and a half we were in this program, we were adopted, and we still are adopted by this couple, but we were adopted by a couple and that were real involved in service and real involved in going. And for the first year and a half, we thought the first step was getting the car. Because that's what they told us. You know, Jim and Fran would call, and they didn't say, meet us at, or do you want to, or they would say, be ready. Be ready, and we'll pick you up. And when they pulled up and they tooted the horn, they said, get in the car. And we went, and thank goodness they did, because, you know, we get to see you and we get to know you. I'm going to do my best to tell you my story today and how the disease of alcoholism has affected me. In order to do that, it's necessary that I mention my alcoholic. And I have a real live alcoholic. And she's here with me today, and I'm going to ask her in just a minute to stand up so y'all, when I call her name and talk about her, you'll know who she is. I think you ought to know. But let me tell you, she is my best friend. And if she'll behave herself, you know, for just another month here, 30th day of this month, we'll celebrate anniversary number 28. And we couldn't have done that without you. We couldn't have done that without getting to you. She's a real live alcoholic, and she's a real live recovering alcoholic, and she hadn't had to take a drink in over 9.5 years, by golly. So when you talk about celebrate the miracle, you know, I want Shirley to stand up because I want you to see one of God's miracles. Something else I want to do before I start telling you a little bit about me. And I've been trying to do this lately from the podium when I get the opportunity to speak in an open meeting. Because I know in an open meeting there's going to be some alcoholics sitting out there. And I want to take this opportunity for just a moment, if you're sitting out there in this room this morning with me and you are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, let me take just a minute to say to you, if you are a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, from the bottom of my heart, thank you. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for a couple of reasons. Thank you, number one, for being there 9.5 years ago when my gal reached out her hand. And you were there with the hand of AA for her. And you took her in. You didn't ask her any questions. You just took her in and you loved her. See, I didn't have her anymore. I'd lost her and I couldn't get her back. You took her in and you showed her how to live sober and you taught her about a new way of life and you gave her back to me. And I wouldn't have her today if it wasn't for you. And I want to take this opportunity to say to you, thank you. But I also want to say thank you for another reason. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, for knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt from 1935 on that what we're involved here involved in is a family disease. And thank you for being loving and caring enough to say to us a few years down the road, yes, you can have our 12 steps too. And you can learn to live a way of life that is absolutely beyond description. That you can get involved in something that is so powerful that no human mind is capable of comprehending the power of this way of life. And you just gave it to us. You just made it available to us. And so come on and get in this, get on, you know, join us on this journey and learn how to be happy, joyous, and free. And God, we just don't tell you thank you enough. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. I appreciate you. I really do. You know, when I introduced myself to you, I told you I was from Hueytown, Alabama, and I am. I live in Hueytown, but my home group's in Bessemer, Alabama. Now, that's the best darn home group in the world. And I hope you think yours is the best group in the world. Bessemer, Alabama, Al-Anon Family Group is the best group in the world. Now, there's an Al-Anon Family Group in Hueytown. And both of these groups lay claims on me. The Hueytown group claims I belong to Bessemer. And there are some times that my home group claims I belong to Hueytown. So you need to know these kind of things so you might know where I'm coming from as you learn a little bit about me today. The other thing that I need to share with you is that I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. Yeah. And when I first got here, I thought being married to her made me an Al-Anon. But I found that that's not true. That's not true. Being married to Shirley qualifies me for Al-Anon. But it doesn't make me an Al-Anon. And you see, it's becoming more and more dear to me and more precious to me. And I realize today what a privilege it is to be afforded the opportunity to be a member of Al-Anon. And to me, a privilege has to be earned. Something that has to be earned. And there are certain things that I have to do in order to earn this privilege and to keep it. And I want to share two or three of these things with you that are important for me in order for me to tell you that my name's Bo and I'm an Al-Anon. Number one, I got to go to meetings. Yeah, I got to suit up and show up. I got to be there. I got to be there. And you know, as I look around me today in our fellowship, I see a lot of people that just quit going to meetings and still think they're a member of Al-Anon. But for me, just for me, it means I got to go to meetings. I got to be there. I hadn't been able to get this down to a meeting a month yet, or a meeting every now and then. You know, it's meetings on a regular basis. Meetings on a regular basis. Number two, and for me, this is just for me now, but I got to have a home group. I think it's important that we have a home group, and let me tell you why. Because when I first got to this fellowship, I didn't have a home group. And I was going to a lot of meetings, but the meetings were out there and over yonder, and I was skipping around. And see, what was going on was I was going to all your meetings, and I was sitting there, and I was listening to all the good things and the laughter, and I was around it. I wasn't in it. I was just around it. And there was nobody getting to know Bo. I was not allowing anybody to know me. And so when problems came and trouble came, nobody knew how to help me. Nobody knew how to help me. But let me tell you what's becoming even more important to me about a home group, people. As I have begun to reap some of the rewards of this way of life, it's become evident to me that along with my growth and my freedom comes a responsibility. And it's there in my home group in Bessemer, Alabama, that I can fulfill the responsibility that I have to Al-Anon family groups. It's there that I can be there and make sure the door is open, and I can make sure the coffee is made, and I can make sure the chairs and the literature are out. And I can be there to have the hand of Al-Anon extended for the newcomer that's coming today, just like the hand of Al-Anon was there for me 9.5 years ago when I came in. And it's there that I can make sure, by being an active member of my home group, that my home group stays within the traditions. And I know today, because old-timers tell me this, Bo, if your group stays within the traditions, it'll stay strong and it'll be there tomorrow and the next day and next month. And so it's there in my home group that I can fulfill this responsibility that I have. It's also necessary for me to have a sponsor. Now, the first 6 months I was in this program, I sponsored myself. And I don't recommend that to anybody. I just don't recommend it. I think sponsorship is one of the most talked about and least utilized things in our fellowship today. And for God's sake, if you're here today and you're new and you don't know about sponsorship, see me when this thing's over and I'll share with you what I know about sponsorship. And I'll share with you what sponsorship has meant to me over the last 9 years. And if you're here today and you're new and you don't have a sponsor, find out something about it and try to get you one as quickly as possible. If you're here and you're an old-timer and you don't have one, shame on you. Shame on you. And the last thing that I would share with you that I have to do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I got to take those 12 simple steps. 12 simple steps for a very complicated person. And to the best of my ability, I got to implement them in my life on a daily basis. Getting up and putting one foot in front of the other and implementing those 12 steps in my life, the best that I'm capable of doing today. And doing it on a daily basis, maintaining a conscious contact with a God that I'm beginning to understand a little more as I go. So these are some of the things that I share with you as I introduce myself to you as an Al-Anon, so that you will know what that means to me. But I think what I'm here for is to tell you a little bit about me, share a little bit of my story. And I have to do that, I have to go back and I have to start it with this simple statement. I was born at a very early age. And I have to go back and I have to start with that statement because, you see, that's where it all began. I was born into that real good breeding ground for AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. Now, I was taken to church Sunday mornings and Sunday nights and on Wednesday nights. And what's important for you to understand is that it was there as a child in that Southern Baptist church in Hueytown, Alabama, that I formed a conception of God that I was going to bring into adulthood with me that was going to cause me some problems. That wasn't the church's fault. I know. I know back there that those Sunday school teachers and those preachers, that they talked about God being loving, God being forgiving. But I also remember them talking about things like, God will get you, you see. And that's what I chose to bring with me into adulthood. And I had God sitting up there wherever it is that he was sitting on this great white throne. And he had that scoreboard out there and Bo's name was on it and he was keeping tabs on Bo. And when I did something good, there was a little check mark. When I did something bad, there was a real big X. And every time the big X went up there, there was a price to be paid. There was punishment. And you see, many years down the road, when the disease of alcoholism reared itself in our home, and things got as bad as they had to get, I was demanding of God that he tell me, Bo, what you have done that's so bad, that you're punishing, I'm getting punished this way. Because I looked on Shirley's drinking and the things that came about as a result of her drinking as a punishment to me, you see, for something I had done. Being active in this church and being active in sports as a youngster, I was never exposed to any drinking. I wasn't around drinking. Didn't drink, didn't get involved in it myself. Just lived a pretty happy life, pretty happy childhood, pretty wholesome. Mid-teens, I meet Shirley. And we start dating. Shirley doesn't drink either at this point. She doesn't drink for entirely different reasons, you see. She came from this alcoholic home. And so she didn't drink for entirely different reasons. But the important thing is that we dated for 5 years. And there was no drinking in this relationship. And as we dated over this 5 years, we began to, you know, we fell madly in love. And at the end of 5 years, we decided that we were going to be able to get along. And we began to talk about marriage. And we sat down and as we got serious about marriage, we sat down and we made a couple of vows to each other. And one was, there'll be no drinking in the home. And this came from Shirley. And that was okay with me because there had never been drinking in the home. And I had no problem with that. And I said, sure, that's okay. And the other vow was, because by this time I came from a divorced home too, there's not going to be any divorce. Well, because of the nature of this convention and what this is all about, you know, and I've already told you we're still married, you know we stood true to half of that. Half of that. Something happened along the way that we didn't plan for and we weren't prepared for. But Shirley and I got married and we set out on this great American dream. Two kids madly in love, ready to tackle the world. And let me tell you what our great American dream consisted of. It consisted of both of us working, having good jobs, making lots of money so we could buy real nice things, so we could impress the neighbors, go deeper in debt, so we'd have to get better jobs to make more money, to buy nicer things, to go deeper in debt. And that's what the great American dream was. It centered around the dollar bill. We had no conception of why we were here, what our purpose in life was. We just knew that we were supposed to work hard and make lots of money and be successful as far as the dollar bill was concerned. And let me tell you, we were good. We were good. We both had good jobs, and we were making enough money to get by and put a little aside. After about a year, we had enough for a down payment on that first little home out there in Hueytown. And we bought that home and got moved in. Two jobs, the great American dream's going on. 3.5 years after we're married, God gave us the most beautiful blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want. And Mike became a part of the great American dream. 17 months later, God gives us the most beautiful brown-eyed baby girl that a daddy could ever want. Just as healthy as she could be, and Sissy became a part of the great American dream. And we sat down and we took stock. And we said, God, look at here. We got two kids. We got two cars. We got two jobs. We got a house. And everything we got is mortgaged to the hilt. And we're happy living the great American dream. Yeah. But you see, that great American dream required that second paycheck. So as quickly as Shirley could, after Sissy was born, she went back to work. And it was at her job, after Sissy was old enough to leave with Mike and Sissy were old enough to leave with a babysitter. It was at this job that Shirley was introduced to a social sorority. And she was asked to join this social sorority, and she did. And it was at one of these social sorority dances one Saturday night, down below Hueytown on the Warrior River. The kids at home with a babysitter tucked away safely in bed. And the lights are down low, and the music's playing soft. And I mixed my wife the first drink of alcohol that she was to ever have in her life. And I walked up to her, and I handed it to her, and I said, here, try this. Try this. And I gave that gal the first drink of alcohol she was to ever have. Now, it wasn't too many years down the road that she was right up in my face. And she was shaking her finger, and she was telling me, Bo, if you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today. Well, see, I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And I didn't know what was going on in our family. I just knew that the great American dream wasn't working and that things weren't right. And I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that I had given her that first drink. And so I accepted all the responsibility. And I took on that load of guilt. And I agreed with her and I told her, yes, you're right. If I had never given you that drink, you wouldn't be this way today. And I absolved her of any guilt or any responsibility for any of the things that were going on in our life as a result of her drinking. And this was a load of guilt that was to get almost unbearable before we got to you. Now, I could stand up here the rest of the day and I could share war stories with you. Well, I've learned something about war stories over the last 9.5 years. My war stories are the same as yours. They're the same. All the names are different, and the times are different, and the places are different. Yeah. But when you get all of that out of the way, what's the same is the pain. The pain is the same. And the feelings and the effects of the disease are the same. So rather than stand up here and just share war stories with you, I'd like to talk with you for just a few minutes about some of those feelings that almost became too much for this old boy. And the first feeling that I would share with you is that feeling of guilt that I talked about. Because, you see, I carried that load of guilt all the way through Shirley's drinking career. All the way through her drinking career. The next feeling that I would share with you that became a very prominent member of my life was that feeling of anger. Now, I don't know about you guys and gals out there, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. And on a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And toward the end of Shirley's drinking, if you had asked me, I could not have honestly told you who or what I was angry at or about. I just knew I was angry. I just knew I was angry. Yeah. That feeling of resentment. God, I resented everything. I resented you if you lived across the street from me. I resented people that could. I resented people that could not. I resented people that had. I resented people that didn't have. It just didn't make any difference. I just resented. I just resented. And I resented God. I resented God. And I was so full of that other thing called self-pity. Oh, God, how could you do this to me? Oh, God, what have I done? Oh, God, what is this all about? Yeah, that was my prayers at that time in my life. Of course, I wasn't getting any answers to those prayers, but boy, I was a praying. I was a praying. You know, another feeling, that feeling of loneliness and isolation. I hear alcoholics talk about the loneliness and isolation of your disease. And I believe you. I believe you. But let me share with you that you don't have a corner on this thing. And in order for me to illustrate this to you, I have to tell you a little bit about Shirley's drinking. Shirley's a kitchen drinker. She got off work at 4 o'clock. She was home at 4:30. And at 4:31, she had a drink in her hand. And she drank until 8:30, 9, 9:30, whatever time it was, that she had had just so much that she literally passed out. Now, she was going to do that, and she was going to pass out, and we didn't know where she was going to pass out. And it didn't make any difference if you was there, if the preacher was there, or who was there. She was going to do it, and she was going to pass out. And this was a daily thing with her, a daily thing. Now, she started this at 4:31 every day, and I knew that. See, I didn't get off work till 5 o'clock. So guess what I had to do at 4:45 every day? I had to call. I could not call. I had to call. And let me tell you, I could smell it over the telephone. Yeah, you're shaking your head. Some of you know what I'm talking about. I could smell it over the telephone. And my answer to this was, if Shirley had started drinking, which usually was the case, was that I didn't go home. I'd go to the water hole up the street with the guys from work. Now, I don't know about a lot of water holes, but let me tell you about the one we went to. It had this big, long bar, and at the end of this big, long bar, it had a big, round table. And 8 or 10 people could get around this big, round table, and that's where we met. That's where the guys from work gathered. And we'd get there, and I never have understood this. Nobody bought their own drinks there. You had to buy a round for the table. All drinks were bought in a round. Okay? And you'd go in there and you'd sit down and somebody'd buy a round. And then as soon as everybody was getting down, you know, somebody, the next one would buy a round. And I can't tell you how many days I was sitting there at that table with other people buying rounds and with me buying my round when it came time. And I would have 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 drinks lined up in front of me that I wasn't going to drink. And that I wasn't going to touch. And that I didn't want. And I'd be sitting there sipping on that one drink. And the thought would be going through my mind, Bo, why are you here? Why are you here? The drinks are here. You don't want them. You're not going to drink them. You've heard all the stories. Because I found out that's what you do at round tables. You just tell the same stories over and over and over again. You know the punchlines to all the jokes. Why are you here? And then the thought will go through my mind, oh, these are your buddies. These are your friends. These are the people you work with every day. These people care about you. Why don't you tell them what's going on? Why don't you ask them if there's some way that they know that you can help, if there's something you can do differently? Oh, but right away the thought will, you can't tell them, Bo. You can't tell them. They won't understand. See, I was the only man on the face of the earth that had a drunk wife at home. And I couldn't tell my best friends because they wouldn't understand. And I would sit there. And I would be lonely. And I would be isolated in a room full of people. Room full of people. So I know about loneliness. I know about isolation. Let me tell you the real sick part to this thing, folks. Shirley's at home in the kitchen drinking, and Daddy's down the street drinking. And there's two kids at home. And they didn't ask for this. They didn't ask for this. Don't tell me this is not a family disease. I know better. I know better. Yeah. So I know about the loneliness and the isolation, but let me tell you about one more feeling, and it explains the reason that I had to go to the water hole with the guys from work. I couldn't go home, because if I went home, I was face to face with my failure, that feeling of failure. And see, I was the dad, and I was the father, and I was the head of the home. And I was supposed to be able to fix anything that came along. And I could. I could fix everything else. I just couldn't fix her. I just couldn't fix her. I could fix the things that happened as a result of it. I could fix the plans that had to be changed because of it. I just couldn't fix her. And if I went home and I was confronted with it, I was confronted with my failure. My failure. So here I am, walking around, so full of guilt and so full of failure that it's just almost unbearable. And yet if you had walked up to me and said, "Bo, how are things going?" That smile would have come, and I would have told you, "I'm fine. I'm fine, thank you." You know, this disease made me one of the most proficient liars in Jefferson County, Alabama. And I was raised different from that. I was raised to know the difference between right and wrong and from telling the truth and not telling the truth. But it made no difference now. I could lie because it was necessary, and I could make it okay. You see, and this gal at Alabama Power Company, she would call me about every other month, and she'd say, "Bo, your power bill hadn't been paid again. And if you don't pay it by 3 o'clock this afternoon, we're going to turn your power off." And I'd kick in immediately. And I'd say to her, "You know, it's funny you should call me today. Shirley just told me last night at home that she hadn't paid the power bill again. And I didn't know about it until last night. And I stopped on the way to work this morning and I dropped you a check in the mail. So there's no need for you to turn our power off. Just wait till 8 o'clock in the morning when the mail runs and you'll have our check." See, that was a lie. Because number one, Shirley hadn't told me. Number two, if I'd have written her a check, it would have bounced. But this gave me till 8 o'clock the next morning to go to brother, to go to uncle, to go to mother, to go to somebody, get the money, be down there at 8 o'clock when they open, pay the power bill, keep it from being turned off. Now, it was okay for me to tell that lie, and it was okay because of the two kids. See, this was my justification. We had two kids. They had baths to get. We had to cook meals for them. They had homework to do. Boom, boom, boom. We needed the power. So the kids made it okay to tell this lie. And I never felt any guilt about that. Okay? I was so justified in telling it. I got in this program, and after I finally got a sponsor, I was sitting there and talking with my sponsor, and we got to talking about honesty one day. You know, sponsors do that. They make you talk about these things. And I began to share about this story. And my sponsor looked at me and said, "Bo, was there ever a time you couldn't get the money?" And I said, "Well, yeah, 2 or 3 times." "Well, what happened?" I said, "Well, they turned the power off." "Well, did the kids hurt?" I said, "Well, no. No, they didn't." But see, we did like anybody living the great American dream. We pulled out that plastic card, that money you don't have. And we told them, "Come on, pack a bag, kids. We're going down to the Day's Inn. We're going to let you swim for a day or two until I could get the money and get the power turned back on." So my sponsor looked at me and said, "So the kids never hurt. The kids never went without." And I said, "No, they didn't." "Well, why do you think you had to tell that lie, Bo?" Let me tell you why I had to tell that lie, and I hope this has never happened to you. But in Hueytown, Alabama, when they turn your power off, they got a red tag. It's about this wide, about this long. And it says on this tag, "We have turned your power off because you ain't paid your bill." And you owe us $432, and when you bring it to us, we'll think about turning your power back on. And they hang that booger right on the front doorknob. And you see, that's the reason I couldn't let the power be turned off. Because I knew they was going to hang that tag on the front door. And if you lived across the street, or you lived up the street from me, then you would know. You would know. And see, we had the curtains pulled there at 2005 28th Avenue. And we didn't let you in. It was total chaos inside that house. It was four individuals living four separate lives under one roof. But when we hit that front door, the smile was on. Yeah. And we didn't let you know. And that's the reason I had to tell that lie, was to keep it from you, keep you from knowing. I got an aunt. This past Valentine's Day, Aunt Katie picked up a 30-year chip in this fellowship. Aunt Katie called me one day at work. She had been sitting over there kind of watching us, keeping an eye on us. She said, "Bo," she said, "how are you handling it out there?" And I said, "Oh, Aunt Katie, everything's fine." She said, "No, it ain't. I ain't going to listen to that anymore." She said, "I want to know. How are you handling it?" And I said, "Well, the kids and I have come up with a new deal. Let me tell you about it." I said, "It seems to be doing some good." And she said, "Well, what is it?" And I said, "Well, every night when Charlie passes out, we get her put in bed, and then the kids and I meet in the den, and then we go on a witch hunt. And we find all her booze. We find it, we know where all her hiding places are. And we dig out all her booze, and we pour the booze out, and then we throw the bottles away." And Aunt Katie just kind of laughed real gently on the other end of the phone. She said, "Bo, I didn't know you were that well off financially." And I said, "What do you mean, Aunt Katie?" And she said, "Well, what does Shirley do the next day on the way home from work?" And I said, "Well, she stops and buys more." And then it dawned on me. She said, "Bo, let her drink what she's got to drink." So you're pouring bucks down the drain. It's not working. And I thanked Aunt Katie, and I told her, I said, "Aunt Katie, I'm going to change." I promised her I would change. And I did. I did change. Now, I got to be honest with you. This is 2.5 years before my wife went into treatment. We didn't stop having the witch hunts. We didn't stop pulling all her booze out. And I never stopped pouring it out. I poured her booze out till the day she went into treatment. I had to do that for me. I had to do that for me. I didn't realize it at the time. But as I look back, I know I had to do it for me. But what I did change was I didn't throw the bottles away anymore. I poured it out, and then I set those dead soldiers up on the drain board. So that when she got up the next morning and walked in the kitchen, she would see them and she would know that we had found it all and that we had poured it out. Now that tells you something about the communication in our relationship at that time. See, we were down to where we were sending messages. Just sending messages. I did this for another 2.5 years before my wife went into treatment. She'd been in treatment a week and a half, and we were sitting up there one day, and we were talking with a counselor, and I was sharing this story, and Shirley's jaw dropped wide open. She said, "My God, Bo, for the last 2 years, I've been walking in the kitchen every morning and saying, 'You dummy, you blacked out and drank it all again.'" Sending messages. Yeah. Let me tell you, our family was just like yours. As long as the drinking continued, things got worse. It's the way it happens in this disease. It just gets worse. I continued to do everything that I knew to try to get my wife to not drink. And nothing I did worked. Finally, one night in July of 1982, the kids and I were getting ready to go to a ball game. And it had been a long time since we had asked Shirley to go to a softball game with us. And I think it had been a long time since she had wanted to go. Because see, when we went off to a softball game, we were gone for 2 or 3 hours. And that left her at home to do what she had to do without us watching over her. And as we were leaving the house that night, Mike, who was 15 years old at that time, Mike turned and looked at his mom, and he said, "Mom, when we get home tonight, will you be passed out on the floor, or will you be passed out on the couch?" And you see, this was the thing that burned through to her, because here was her 15-year-old son speaking to her with absolutely no respect. How dare him do this? And this was very, very out of character for Mike to do that. But I know today that it was Mike's place to say that, that that was being taken care of by somebody else, because that was the thing that burned through to his mom. And Mike didn't wait for an answer, and we went out there and got in the car, and we went to the ball game. And when we got back home that night, we knew that something was different, because you see, the front door was open, and Shirley was up. She wasn't passed out. And we got out, and we walked in the house, and when we got in there, we knew, you know, she wasn't drunk. She had been drinking, but she wasn't drunk. And she met us at the door, and she told us that she had made a decision that she had to do something about her drinking, and that she had called a treatment center, and that she was making arrangements to go into treatment. And I reacted today just like I know I was supposed to. I reacted that day. I looked at her and I told her, "Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's going to be different this time?" And I told her I didn't believe her, and I took a shower and I went to bed. And it was the next day when this treatment center called me for some insurance information that I believed her. Now, let me tell you, God was looking out for us and taking care of us right then. Right then. Because God directed us to a treatment center that believes wholeheartedly in treating alcoholism as a family disease and believes wholeheartedly in the three 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. And there were some treatment centers in our area at that time that did not treat it that way. And we didn't know the difference. We didn't know. So God was taking care of us, and we didn't even realize it. We made the arrangements, and we get ready to put Mama in treatment. We're going to take her up there for 28 days and go back and get her, and everything's going to be fine. We're going to go on about the great American dream. You should have seen us that day we took her up there. I had a pickup truck at that time. The kids put two lounge chairs. Mike's 15, Sissy's 13. Put two lounge chairs in the back of the truck, got them a cooler full of Pepsi, had their big radio, their blaster. They're back there in the back of the pickup. Me and Mom's up front, and off to treatment we go. Just trucking off. We get up there, and we pull up, and we get her bags out, and we get her in, and we get her admitted. And then this counselor up there says, "I'd like to talk to y'all for just a minute before you leave." Said, "We have something up here called Family Week. Said, it's going to happen in a couple of weeks," and says, "That's when we want y'all to come up here, you and both kids, because they're old enough. I want you to come in Monday and stay till Friday and be a part of the treatment process." Said, "I'm not going to explain a whole lot to you about it right now. I'll send you a letter. I just wanted to make you aware of it." And he puts us out, and we wave to Mom as we drive off. As we're going home, the kids are getting a little bit upset with me. They're sitting up front, and they said, "Dad, we don't know about this. See, it's this family week's going to be during August. They're out of school. Their summer vacation. They had kind of scoped the place out while we were up there. And they started telling me things like, 'Dad, they don't have a swimming pool up there. And, Dad, there's no Coke machines up there. They don't drink anything but fruit juice. And, Dad, there's no TVs in the room. And, Dad, they don't even have hamburgers. And we're not sure we want to go.'" And I told them, I said, "Wait a minute, kids, settle down. We're not going up there for that thing. Don't worry about it." I said, "Don't you worry about it anymore. Put it to rest. We're not going. There's no need for us to go. There's nothing wrong with us." I was just being nice to that guy. It was his job to tell me about it, and I was just being nice to him. Well, about a week later, the letter came. And I'm sitting there and I'm reading the letter, and there's a statement in the letter that just jumps off the page at me. And that statement says, "We want you to come up here and learn how to live with your alcoholic." Now, that made sense. So I called the kids in and I said, "Look, we might better think about going, because they want us to come up there and learn how to keep your mom sober. And we need to go. We need to go. We need to get this education about what we've got to do in order to ensure her sobriety, keep her sober." So I said, maybe we better think about going. And we had a little family conference there, and we realized two or three things. Number one, we had darn good insurance that was going to pay for all of it, so it wasn't going to cost us anything. Number two, the kids were out of school, so they wouldn't have to be kept out of school. Number three, I was like any good untreated Al-Anon. I had 6 years of unused vacation time. And so there was no reason to not go. No reason to not go. And we made the decision to go, and we went up there. Now, I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on Family Week, but I'm going to share two or three things that happened. Number one, is we got up there, and we checked in, and they told us to be in this group room in about 30 minutes. And we got up there in that group room, and there was 18 of us family members representing about six patients. And we were all sitting around this group room, and we had not been in there 5 minutes till I was in a standing up, shouting argument with the counselor. Yeah. And I tell you how bad I was. He started with me. 18 people, and he started with me. But you know what we were shouting about? He asked me something about me. And I told him it was none of his business, that we weren't there about me, that anything he needed to know about her, I would be glad to tell him, that we were there about her, and that I was there to help him in any way I could. And he said, no, Bo, this week is about you. And he said, this week we're going to show you how you have been affected by the disease of alcoholism. And we're going to show you how you deserve recovery too, and we're going to tell you where you can get it. So he said, this week's about you. And I was ready for him. I yanked that letter out. I said, that ain't what your letter says. I said, your letter says come up here and learn how to live with your alcoholic. Now there's 18 family members in that room, and every one of them got a letter just like mine. The counselor wrote it. But I read the whole letter to him. And I said, if we're up here about me, you lied to me in this letter. And he just laughed at me and said, yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. He said, but just think, Bo. He said, if I'd have wrote you a letter that told you alcoholism's a family disease and you're entitled to recovery too, and we want you to come on up here and find out about it, what would you have done? And you see, he had to lie to me to get me there because I wouldn't have gone. I wouldn't have gone. But let me tell you, they started telling me and teaching me that my wife had a disease called alcoholism. And they taught me enough about that disease for me to understand that it was a disease, just enough to know that my wife was sick. And they taught me about the three C's, that I didn't cause it, I couldn't control it, and I darn sure couldn't cure it. And I needed to hear that I didn't cause it. Because you know what I took up there with me? I took that load of guilt with me. Yeah, that was about to break my back. And when I learned that my wife had a disease and that I didn't cause it, then it became clear to me that way back down there several years prior to that, on the Warrior River, at that sorority dance, when I handed my wife that drink, I introduced her to alcohol, not alcoholism. And I was not responsible for her being an alcoholic. Next thing that happened up there is this gal came up there and held an Al-Anon meeting for us. Sure did. Right there. Held an Al-Anon meeting for us. Now, there's 18 of us in that Al-Anon meeting. 19, including her. And the way I remember that meeting is she never spoke to another one of those people. She started every statement with, Bo. It was that pointed to me. And she told me things like, Bo, when Shirley gets out of this treatment center, if she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, period. If she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, period. If you want to regain any of your sanity and begin to experience any serenity in your life, you're going to go to Al-Anon. Period. Yeah. Wasn't no ifs and ands. It was just that way. And she said, I hope you choose to go, and if you do, I want to give you a couple of little hints. She said, number one, when you go to your meetings, I want you to go at least 30 minutes early and be prepared to stay at least 30 minutes late. Because she said, I want you to go to every meeting you go to with an open mind, with a positive attitude, looking for something that's going to help you in your recovery. And if you go looking for it, it'll be there. It'll be there. But she said, it may not be said during the meeting. It may be said during the fellowship before or after. And you don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss it. So go early and be prepared to stay late. And she said, when you get there, you pick you out a winner. And until the fog can clear and you can begin to understand a few things, she said, you do everything that that winner does. If that winner goes to get a cup of coffee, you go get a cup of coffee. Yeah. Because she said, winners talk at the coffee pot. And there might be something said that you need to hear and you don't want to miss it. You don't want to miss it. Yeah. And that was the kind of instructions I had to come to you people. Yeah, that was it. My wife got out of that treatment program, and we sat down, me and her and the two kids, and we discussed this thing called family recovery, and we decided that we wanted to give it a shot. We really wanted to give it a shot. We asked the kids to go to Alateen. We asked them to go to four meetings, one a week for 4 weeks, and then they could make a decision about where they thought they fit into this thing. They went for those 4 weeks, one meeting a week for 4 weeks, and we sat down and talked, and Sissy had fallen in love with it. She had found her place. She just absolutely loved it. Mike looked at us, and he said, I don't know. He said, I'm not so sure it's for me. He said, Mom, I'll support you in your sobriety in any way I can, but I don't think those meetings are for me. You see, Mike was blonde-headed, he was blue-eyed, he was 15 years old, he was good-looking, he had a motorcycle, and he had some chasing to do. I think he did some catching, too, because he was good at it. Yeah. And Mike chose not to go to Alateen. Well, let me tell you. Let me tell you about him. He lived a program. He worked a program, and he lived a program. You know why? Because he lived in a home where the program was. Yeah. He was right amongst it. Right amongst it. Sissy, she stayed in Alateen for 7 years, graduated into Al-Anon, and then became the Alateen sponsor for the group that she was raised in. Yeah. She'll be 23 years old next Friday. She's graduated college. Some crazy idea. She got a degree in counseling. Decides she wants to work with families. Don't understand where that came from. And just a couple of weeks ago, got her first job. And she's now self-supporting through her own contributions. And we're grateful for that. We're grateful for that. Yeah, but we set out on this journey. Shirley was real serious about her recovery. They had told her she needed to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and we did. We did. I went to make sure she was there. Because you see, I was going to do everything I could to keep her sober. Everything. Now, she got a sponsor. She began to work steps. She began to talk to God. She began to get better. I was coming to your meetings, and I was enjoying it. I was just as happy, had the biggest smile, was just as at home with you folks. Loved it, because she was out there. She was in that other room, and she wasn't drinking. And I was happy. And I didn't need your steps. And I didn't need a sponsor. And I didn't need your program, you see. And my wife's out there working a program, and she's getting better, and I'm not, and the gap between us is getting wider. Yeah, getting wider. And this went on for about 6 months. And finally, I came home from one of those meetings one night after about 6 months in this thing, and I looked at her, and I said, why is it Why is it I'm so miserable? They tell me to keep coming back, things are going to get better. And I said, why is it I'm so miserable? What are you doing? And she was able to share with me what she was doing. Things like, Bo, I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I'm working the steps. I talk to God. She said, why don't you go back to Bessemer? Why don't you quit going to a meeting somewhere? She said, yeah, I'm going to a meeting every night. Why don't you go to Bessemer? Why don't you make Bessemer your home group? And why don't you get you a sponsor and do some of these things? And I didn't have any choice. I did not have any choice. And I went back to Bessemer the next night, and when the meeting was over, I grabbed a gal named Fran. So there weren't any more male Al-Anons in my area at that time. And I grabbed Fran, and I sat her down. I said, Fran, I need a sponsor. Will you be my sponsor? And she had a temporary lapse of sanity and agreed to. Fran's old enough to be my mom. Fran's a retired school teacher. Yeah, just what I need. Just what I need. But Fran put a condition on it. She said, Bo, I'm willing to sponsor you if you're willing to go to work. I said, well, no problem. Because, see, work meant being up front, chairing the meetings, visible, picking the speakers, picking the topics, taking care, taking charge. She said, no, that's not what I'm talking about, Bo. She said, I'm talking about I'm willing to sponsor you if you're ready to go to work on yourself. I said, how do I do that, friend? She said, we got 12 steps to take care of that, honey. She said, if you're willing tonight to make a conscious commitment to start trying to implement these steps in your life on a daily basis, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. Yeah. That was 9 years ago, and she still got me by the hand, and she's still walking with me. You betcha. You know, as a friend of ours, we have a videotape by him, and he's got a song he sings on it. Says, there ought to be a Hall of Fame for mamas. I believe that, but let me tell you, I know there's a Hall of Fame for sponsors. I know that. If you ain't got one, get you one. Get you one. It wasn't too far into this sponsor relationship that Fran and I decided that there needed to be a male in this thing. And I said, Fran, there's no male Al-Anons around. She said, I know it, but there's a lot of male AAs around. And she said, there's a lot of them that are working 12 steps. She said, why don't you get you one? And I made, probably was one of the best decisions I ever made in my life. I asked her husband. Yeah. I asked Jim. And Jim and Fran sat down with me. And they did something that has always, it was done for me. I know. I had to give both of them permission for me to be an open book between the two of them. I couldn't run to Jim with this and to Fran with that. They stopped me because they knew me. And I began to get involved, and I began to do a few things to me, and I began to feel a little bit of relief, a little bit of success in this program, and then I got to trying to do an inventory. Let me tell you, I was having problems doing the inventory. I call up one day, it's Fran I need to run by, and I run by that afternoon and say, hey, I'm having problems writing this inventory. She didn't even know I'd started on it. And she looked at me, she said, oh, I know you're having problems. I said, how do you know that? Where do you get all this wisdom? How do you know that? She said, Bo, you can't do step four till you're through with step three. She said, you're getting steps out of order again, son. She said, I think you need to get back in step three because you still got God sitting up there judging you. You still got God punishing you. You better get back in step three and you better do something about this concept of God. And I sat down and I talked with Jim, and Jim took me into the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm one of those Al-Anons that believes in reading and studying the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't misunderstand me. I did not say put down your Al-Anon literature. I said find some extra time and read and study the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me into the chapter to the agnostic, and it was there that I was able to do something about this concept of God. Because you see, there's a story in there somewhere around page 56 about a minister's son who's having a spiritual awakening. And he said he fell to his knees, and he found himself surrounded by infinite power and love. and he had stepped from the bridge to the shore, and he stood in conscious companionship with his Creator. I said, wow, infinite power and love. Infinite, never-ending power, never-ending love. That's it. That's it. Available to me. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, when I choose to tap into it. I didn't understand that part about stepping from the bridge to the shore. So Jim took me back into the book, and it's explained this way. It says, some of us have already stepped far over the bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. I said, all right. Because you see, the bridge of reason to me is understanding, and I stayed so caught up in understanding. Understanding. And I needed to get out of understanding and step off that bridge of reason to the desired shore of faith. And faith to me is acceptance. Get out of understanding and into acceptance. And that was to mean a lot to me just a few years down the road. And I had this new concept of God. But I'm still fighting it. And I got up one Wednesday morning and I looked at Shirley and I said, Shirley, I don't want to go to work. She said, God, take a day off. You got plenty of time. I said, I don't want to stay home. I wanted to get away from me. Because I was still fighting God. And I finally decided I'd go on to work, that I could be as miserable at work as I could anywhere and that I'd get paid for it. And so I went to work. I started to work. About 8:05 that Wednesday morning. I pulled my truck off the busiest street in Bessemer, Alabama, and I sat there on the side of that road, and I beat on the steering wheel, and I hollered at God. And I told him, I said, God, I don't know what I got. I don't know what you want. I don't know where we're going. But I can't fight you anymore. I just can't fight you anymore. Then for the first time in my life, I took step 3. Good morning. But I'm still in the Baptist church, see, into that theology, and I think you just do it one time. Just one time. I found out for me that's not true. That's not true. That the third step is a regular part of my life. And I've not even gotten to the point yet that I can just do it daily. It has to be done many times a day. Many times a day. But let me tell you, that morning, if those feelings of anger and those feelings of worry and those feelings of resentment and self-pity and confusion and despair, if those feelings could have been water, then it made a puddle around my feet as I felt them drain away. Drain away. And I felt some relief. And I went on to work that day, and I didn't have a vision, and there wasn't a clap of thunder, and there wasn't a flash of lightning. Didn't see the burning bush. But you know what? When I got home that day, I wasn't worn out. And I wasn't angry. And my family noticed the difference. My family noticed the difference. Yeah. And it's just been a slow progress. A process. Yeah. Slow process. But you know, life's not always fair. But it's a darn sight better than it used to be. I want to share with you as I close a few of the things that have come to me as a result of getting involved in these 12 steps, of working these 12 steps to the best of my ability on a daily basis in my life. And let me share with you just a few things. The first thing that I would share with you that I've been given as a result of this program is I have been given freedom. Freedom. Freedom from that load of guilt. Freedom from that despair. Freedom from that confusion. Freedom from that resentment and that anger. It's not that these things don't crop back up in my life, because they do. They crop back up in the form of daily living problems. But what I've been given is the freedom of choice of whether they stay or not. The freedom of choice of whether I hold on to them or whether I get with you and I do something about them. The next thing I'd share with you that this program's given me is it's given me hope. That's our message anyhow, isn't it? Message of hope. Light at the end of the tunnel. It ain't as good as it's going to be, but it's a darn sight better than it was. Yeah. This program gave me a new concept of God. I've already shared that with you. That's working for me today. And I got it right here. Right here. This program gave me back to me. Because when I got here, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was. And today, thanks to you people, I'm beginning to get a little bit of a handle on who I am and what I am. And I think even more important, what I am not. You know, I think that's important too, to know what I am not. But the last thing that I would share with you is probably the most important thing that this program has given me. And the most important thing that this program has given me is it's given me you. It's given me you. Because you see, I remember hearing when I first got here, Bo, you don't ever have to be alone again. You don't ever have to do this alone again. And I'm like that little frightened child. You know, their mom's already put her to bed and she's tucked her in and they've said their prayers and mom goes downstairs and then the storm starts. And the rain's beating on the window and the winds are blowing outside and the lightning and the thunder and it's scary and the little girl begins to cry. And mom goes up to see about her. And when she gets up there, she sits down on the side of the bed and she begins to smooth her hair and she begins to tell her, honey, it's only a storm and you're safe. And you know that God loves you. And you know that God is going to keep you in His arms and you know that God's going to take care of you. And a little girl looked up at her and said, yeah, Mom, I know about God. And I know that God loves me. And I know that God's going to protect me. And I know that God's going to keep me safe in His arms. But just tonight, Mom, right now, I need somebody with skin on them. Yeah. Yeah. And God knew that about me. He knew that I was going to need somebody with skin on them. So He gave me you. He gave me you. Because see, the night came. Almost 4 years ago, May 17, 1988, when Shirley and I had to open the door at midnight and look at three policemen that told us that our 20-year-old blonde-headed, blue-eyed hunk had been killed by a drunk driver. And everything that I had learned, everything that you had taught me, went right out the window. And I went right back. Why me, God? Why me? How could you do this to me, God? And of all things, a drunk driver. How could you do this? Why? But let me share with you. And I think this is the reason, really, that I share with you about Mike. It's a part of our story. But let me share with you about you and your part in this story. I went to the phone and I called my mom and she said, we'll be right over and we'll call you brother and sister. And I called my sponsor. And I can remember my sponsor telling me, my sponsor didn't tell me, Bo, read page so-and-so and I'll talk to you in the morning. My sponsor didn't say pray about it. I remember my sponsor saying to me, hang up the phone. And I said, friend, I don't want to hang up the phone because, see, I had her voice on the other end of it. She said, honey, I can't come to you as long as I'm talking to you on the phone. 45 minutes later, A.A. and Al-Anon was in our home. And you didn't leave us. You did not leave us. You were there. That's what this program's about. You were there. Mike was killed on Tuesday night. Wednesday night. We know the wreck happened somewhere around 9 o'clock. Wednesday night at 9 o'clock in our front yard, 15 Alateens form a circle of love and put Sissy in the center of it. And they stay there from 15 till 9 till 15 after. And they love her through it. You don't get that anywhere but here. Right here. Right here. Let me tell you about my boy. The last time I saw him alive was 7 o'clock that Tuesday morning as he was getting ready to go to work. And as he was going out the door, he stopped by my chair where I was sitting there drinking coffee. And he reached down and he patted me on the shoulder. He said, I'm going to work, Dad. I love you, Dad. I love you, Dad. the last words I ever heard my son speak. I love you, Dad. We got that here. We got that here. Yeah. God, what a loving, giving child he was. I just wish you had had the opportunity to know him. Yeah. But you stayed with us 24 hours a day. And we were not capable of making decisions. But we didn't have to because you were there. And you made the decisions for us. We were not capable of praying. There came a time in our life, in sobriety, in recovery, when we didn't have a prayer. But you were there, and you prayed for us. You prayed for us. Yeah. Thursday night at the funeral home, Shirley and I are standing there. We look up, and the line's all the way down the center of the funeral home and out the door and on the sidewalk. I say this to let you know what kind of boy Mike was. Over 600 people signed the book that night at the funeral home. And we look out there in the line. There's no alcoholic in College Park, Georgia, sitting right over there. Comes walking in that funeral home in Bessemer, Alabama. That's what this program's about. That's what it's about. A couple of weeks later, Shirley was just beyond going, and I got her one morning, I loaded her up, and I took her over to her sponsor's house. And when I got there, Katie looked at me and she said, "We'll call you when it's time to come get her. That may be this afternoon, it may be tomorrow, it may be next week. We'll call. She's in good hands." And I left her. They called me about 8 hours later. And I went back. And I share this with you because I want you to know what I saw when I walked in to Katie's kitchen where my wife had been for 8 hours. And Katie smokes. So there was an ashtray and a pack of cigarettes sitting there on the table. And there were two coffee cups sitting there on the kitchen table. And it was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sitting there on that table. And my wife has been getting a little bit better since that point. I don't know everything they did that day, but I do know that everything they did was centered around an ashtray, two coffee cups, and the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So just how powerful is this thing? I don't know how powerful it is. My simple mind is not capable of comprehending the power of this way of life. I know this. I know there's a real live alcoholic sitting right out here on the front row. And I watched her walk through the pain of the death of her son and not have to take a drink. And I suggest to you that's powerful. That's powerful. There's a real live Al-Anon standing in front of you who has not had to load the shotgun and go get a drunk driver. And I planned it. But you were there and you recognized it. And you came to me and you took care of me. So I know it's powerful. I know it's powerful. If you're new here, you're in the right place. The answer is here. The answer is here. I hope that you understand why I say to you that you are the most important thing that this program has given me. And if you do understand just how vital you are and just how important you are to me, then I want to close by making this deal with you. I'm going to keep coming back. And I want you to keep coming back. And if I keep coming back, and you keep coming back, then I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that our paths will cross again as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for being here with me.